and sealed vaults, Karis told him, another in the floor and two in the walls. They missed them all. They can't have looked very hard. Most treasuries have hiding places. People know that. Especially robbers. So maybe the cash wasn't their first priority. Exactly. Karis locked the chest and put it back in its vault. If they didn't want the ornaments, and they weren't sufficiently interested in cash to search the treasury thoroughly for hidden vaults, why did they come here at all? To kill Tilly. The robbery was a cover. Merthyn thought about that. They didn't need an elaborate cover story, he said after a pause. If all they wanted was to kill Tilly, they could have done it in the dormitory, and been far away from here by the time the nuns got back from matins. If they had done it carefully, suffocated her with a feather pillow, say, we would not even have been sure she had been murdered. It would have looked as if she had died in her sleep. Then there's no explanation for the attack. They ended up with next to nothing. A few gold coins. Merthyn looked around the underground chamber. Where are the charters? He said. They must have burned. It doesn't much matter. I've got copies of everything. Parchment doesn't burn very well. I've never tried to light it. It smoulders, shrinks and distorts, but it doesn't catch fire. Perhaps the charters have been retrieved from the debris. Let's check. They climbed back up the steps and left the vault. Outside in the cloisters, Karis asked Joan, "Have you found any parchment among the ashes?" She shook her head. "Nothing at all. Could you have missed it?" "I don't think so. Not unless it has burned to cinders. Merthyn says it doesn't burn." She turned to him. "Who would want our charters? They're no use to anyone else." Merthyn followed the thread of his own logic, just to see where it might lead. "Suppose there's a document that you've got, or you might have, or they think you might have, and they want it. What could it be?" Merthyn frowned. "Documents are intended to be public. The whole point of writing something down is so that people can look at it in the future. A secret document is a strange thing." Then he thought of something. He drew Karis away from Joan and walked casually around the cloisters with her until he was sure they could not be overheard. Then he said, "But, of course, we do know of one secret document." "The letter Thomas buried in the forest." "Yes, but why would anyone imagine it might be in the nunnery's treasury?" "Well, think. Has anything happened lately that might arouse such a suspicion?" A look of dismay came over Karis's face. "Oh, my soul," she exclaimed. "There is something. I told you about Lynn Grange being given to us by Queen Isabella for accepting Thomas all those years ago. Did you speak to anyone else about it?" "Yes, the bailiff of Lynn. And Thomas was angry that I had done so, and said there would be dire consequences. So someone is afraid you might have got hold of Thomas's secret letter." "Ralph?" "I don't think Ralph is aware of the letter. I was the only one of us children who saw Thomas burying it. He certainly never mentioned it. Ralph must be acting on behalf of someone else." Karis looked scared. "Queen Isabella? Or the king himself? Is it possible that the king ordered Ralph to invade a nunnery?" "Not personally, no. He would have used an intermediary, someone loyal, ambitious, and with absolutely no scruples. I came across such men in Florence, hanging around the Doge's palace. They're the scum of the earth. I wonder who it was." "I think I can guess," said Merthyn. Gregory Longfellow met Ralph and Alan 2 days later at Wigley, in the small timber manor house. Wigley was more discreet than Tench. At Tench Hall, there were too many people watching Ralph's every move, servants, followers, his parents. Here in Wigley, the peasants had their own back-breaking business to do, and no one would question Ralph about the contents of the sack Alan was carrying. I gather it went off as planned, Gregory said. News of the invasion of the nunnery had spread all over the county in no time. No trouble, Ralph said. He was a bit let down by Gregory's muted reaction. After all the trouble that had been taken to get the charters, Gregory might have shown some elation. The sheriff has announced an inquest, of course, Gregory said dourly. They'll blame it on outlaws. You were not recognized? We wore hoods. Gregory looked at Ralph strangely. I did not know that your wife was at the nunnery. A useful coincidence, Ralph said. It enabled me to kill two birds with one stone. The strange look intensified. What was the lawyer thinking? Was he going to pretend to be shocked that Ralph had killed his wife? If so, Ralph was ready to point out that Gregory was complicit in everything that had happened at the nunnery. He had been the instigator. He had no right to judge. Ralph waited for Gregory to speak. But, after a long pause, all he said was, "Let's have a look at these charters." They sent the housekeeper, Vira, on a lengthy errand, and Ralph made Alan stand at the door to keep out casual callers. Then Gregory tipped the charters out of the sack onto the table. He made himself comfortable and began to examine them. Some were rolled and tied with string, others bundled flat, a few sewn together in booklets. He opened one, read a few lines in the strong sunlight coming through the open windows, then threw the charter back into the sack and picked up another. Ralph had no idea what Gregory was looking for. He had only said that it might embarrass the king. Ralph could not imagine what kind of document Carys might possess that would embarrass a king. He got bored watching Gregory read, but he was not going to leave. He had delivered what Gregory wanted, and he was going to sit here until Gregory confirmed his half of the deal. The tall lawyer worked his way patiently through the documents. One caught his attention, and he read it all the way through, but then he threw it in the sack with the others. Ralph and Alan had spent most of the last week in Bristol. It was not likely that they would be asked to account for their movements, but they had taken precautions anyway. They had caroused at taverns every evening except the night they went to Kingsbridge. Their companions would remember the free drinks, but probably would not recall that on one night of the week Ralph and Alan had been absent, or, if they did, they certainly would not know whether it was the fourth Wednesday after Easter or the Thursday but two before Whitsun. At last the table was clear, and the sack was full again. Ralph said, "Did you not find what you were looking for?" Gregory did not answer the question. "You brought everything?"
"Everything."
"Good.
So you haven't found it?"
Gregory chose his words carefully, as always. "The specific item is not here. However, I did come across a deed that may explain why this issue has arisen in recent months."
"So you're satisfied?" Ralph persisted.
"Yes."
"And the king need no longer be anxious?"
Gregory looked impatient. "You should not concern yourself with the king's anxieties. I'll do that."
"Then I can expect my reward immediately."
"Oh, yes," said Gregory. "You shall be the Earl of Shiring by harvest time."
Ralph felt a glow of satisfaction. The Earl of Shiring, at last. He had won the prize he had always longed for, and his father was still alive to hear the news.
"Thank you," he said. "If I were you," said Gregory, "I should go and woo Lady Philippa."
"Woo her?" Ralph was astonished.
Gregory shrugged. "She has no real choice in the matter, of course, but still, the formalities should be observed. Tell her that the king has given you permission to ask for her hand in marriage, and say you hope she will learn to love you as much as you love her."
"Oh," said Ralph. "All right."
"Take her a present," said Gregory.
Chapter 73. On the morning of Tilly's burial, Carys and Merthyn met on the roof of the cathedral at dawn. The roof was a world apart. Calculating the acreage of slates was a perennial geometry exercise in the advanced mathematics class at the Priory School. Workmen needed constant access for repairs and maintenance, so a network of walkways and ladders linked the slopes and ridges, corners and gullies, turrets and pinnacles, gutters and gargoyles. The crossing tower had not yet been rebuilt, but the view from the top of the west facade was impressive. The priory was already busy. This would be a big funeral. Tilly had been a nobody in life, but now she was the victim of a notorious murder, a noblewoman killed in a nunnery, and she would be mourned by people who had never spoken three words to her. Carys would have liked to discourage mourners, because of the risk of spreading the plague, but there was nothing she could do. The bishop was already here, in the best room of the prior's palace, which was why Carys and Merthyn had spent the night apart, she in the nun's dormitory, and he and Lola at the holly bush. The grieving widower, Ralph, was in a private room upstairs at the hospital. His baby, Jerry, was being taken care of by the nuns. Lady Philippa and her daughter Odila, the only other surviving relatives of the dead girl, were also staying at the hospital. Neither Merthyn nor Carys had spoken to Ralph when he arrived yesterday. There was nothing they could do, no way to get justice for Tilly, for they could prove nothing. But all the same, they knew the truth. So far, they had told no one what they believed. There was no point. During today's obsequies, they would have to pretend something like normalcy with Ralph. It was going to be difficult. While the important personages slept, the nuns and the priory employees were hard at work preparing the funeral dinner. Smoke was rising from the bakery, where dozens of long 4-pound loaves of wheat bread were already in the oven. Two men were rolling a new barrel of wine across to the prior's house. Several novice nuns were setting up benches and a trestle table on the green for the common mourners. As the sun rose beyond the river, throwing a slanting yellow light on the rooftops of Kingsbridge, Carys studied the marks made on the town by 9 months of plague. From this height, she could see gaps in the rows of houses, like bad teeth. Timber buildings collapsed all the time, of course, because of fire, rain damage, incompetent construction, or just old age. What was different now was that no one bothered to repair them. If your house fell down, you just moved into one of the empty homes in the same street. The only person building anything was Merthyn, and he was seen as a mad optimist with too much money. Across the river, the gravediggers were already at work in another newly consecrated cemetery. The plague showed no signs of relenting. Where would it end? Would the houses just continue to fall down, one at a time, until there was nothing left, and the town was a wasteland of broken tiles and scorched timbers, with a deserted cathedral in the middle and a 100-acre graveyard at its edge? "I'm not going to let this happen," she said. Merthyn did not at first understand. "The funeral," he said, frowning. Carys made a sweeping gesture to take in the city and the world beyond it. Everything. Drunks maiming one another. Parents abandoning their sick children on the doorstep of my hospital. Men queuing to fuck a drunken woman on a table outside the White Horse. Livestock dying in the pastures. Half-naked penitents whipping themselves, then collecting pennies from bystanders. And most of all, a young mother brutally murdered here in my nunnery. I don't care if we are all going to die of the plague. As long as we're still alive, I'm not going to let our world fall apart. What are you going to do? She smiled gratefully at Merthyn. Most people would have told her she was powerless to fight the situation, but he was always ready to believe in her. She looked at the stone angels carved on a pinnacle, their faces blurred by hundreds of years of wind and rain, and she thought of the spirit that had moved the cathedral builders. "We're going to re-establish order and routine here. We're going to force Kingsbridge people to return to normal, whether they like it or not. We're going to rebuild this town and its life, despite the plague."
All right, he said. This is the moment to do it. Because everyone is so angry about Tilly, and because they're frightened at the thought that armed men can come into the town at night and murder whomever they will, they think no one's safe. What will you do? I'm going to tell them it must never happen again.
This must never happen again, she cried, and her voice rang out across the graveyard and echoed off the ancient grey walls of the cathedral. A woman could never speak out as part of a service in church, but the graveside ceremony was a grey area, a solemn moment that took place outside the church, a time when lay people, such as the family of the deceased, would sometimes make speeches or pray aloud. All the same, Caris was sticking her neck out. Bishop Henri was officiating, backed up by Archdeacon Lloyd and Canon Claude. Lloyd had been diocesan clerk for decades, and Claude was a colleague of Henri's from France. In such distinguished clerical company, it was audacious for a nun to make an unscheduled speech. Such considerations had never meant much to Caris, of course. She spoke just as the small coffin was being lowered into the grave. Several of the congregation had begun to cry. The crowd was at least 500 strong, but they fell silent at the sound of her voice. Armed men have come into our town at night and killed a young woman in the nunnery, and I will not stand for it, she said. There was a rumble of assent from the crowd. She raised her voice. The priory will not stand for it. The bishop will not stand for it. And the men and women of Kingsbridge will not stand for it. The support became louder, the crowd shouting, No! And Amen! People say the plague is sent by God. I say that when God sends rain, we take shelter. When God sends winter, we build up the fire. When God sends weeds, we pull them up by the roots. We must defend ourselves. She glanced at Bishop Henri. He was looking bemused. He had had no warning of this sermon, and if he had been asked for his permission, he would have refused it. But he could tell that Caris had the people on her side, and he did not have the nerve to intervene. What can we do? She looked around. All faces were turned to her expectantly. They had no idea what to do, but they wanted a solution from her. They would cheer at anything she said, if only it gave them hope. We must rebuild the city wall, she cried. They roared their approval. A new wall that is taller and stronger and longer than the broken-down old one, she caught the eye of Ralph. A wall that will keep murderers out. The crowd shouted, Yes! Ralph looked away. And we must elect a new constable and a force of deputies and sentries to uphold the law and enforce good behavior. Yes! There will be a meeting of the parish guild tonight to work out the practical details, and the guild's decisions will be announced in church next Sunday. Thank you, and God bless you all. At the funeral banquet in the grand dining hall of the prior's palace, Bishop Henri sat at the head of the table. On his right was Lady Philippa, the widowed Countess of Shiring. Next to her was seated the chief mourner, Tilly's widower, Sir Ralph Fitzgerald. Ralph was delighted to be next to Philippa. He could stare at her breasts while she concentrated on her food, and every time she leaned forward, he could peek down the square neckline of her light summer dress. She did not know it yet, but the time was not far away when he would command her to take off her clothes and stand naked in front of him, and he would see those magnificent breasts in their entirety. The dinner provided by Caris was ample but not extravagant, he noted. There were no gilded swans or towers of sugar, but there was plenty of roasted meat, boiled fish, new bread, beans, and spring berries. He helped Philippa to some soup made of ground chicken with almond milk. She said to him gravely, This is a terrible tragedy. You have my most profound sympathy. People had been so compassionate that sometimes, for a few moments, Ralph thought of himself as the pitiable victim of a dreadful bereavement, and forgot that he was the one who had slid the knife into Tilly's young heart.
"Thank you," he said solemnly. "Tilly was so young. But we soldiers get used to sudden death.
One day a man will save your life, and swear eternal friendship and loyalty, and the next day he is struck down by a crossbow bolt through the heart, and you forget him." She gave him an odd look that reminded him of the way Sir Gregory had regarded him, with a mixture of curiosity and distaste, and he wondered what it was about his attitude to Tilly's death that provoked this reaction. Philippa said,
"You have a baby boy?"
"Jerry. The nuns are looking after him today. But I'll take him home to Tench Hall tomorrow. I've found a wet nurse." He saw an opportunity to drop a hint. "Of course. He needs someone to mother him properly."
"Yes."
He recalled her own bereavement. "But you know what it is to lose your spouse."
"I was fortunate to have my beloved William for 25 years.
"You must be lonely." This might not be the moment to propose, but he thought to edge the conversation towards the subject.
"Indeed. I lost my 3 men, William and our 2 sons. The castle seems so empty."
"But not for long, perhaps." She stared at him as if she could not believe her ears, and he realized he had said something offensive. She turned away and spoke to Bishop Henri on her other side. On Ralph's right was Philippa's daughter, Odila. "Would you like some of this pasty?" he said to her. "It's made with peacocks and hares." She nodded, and he cut her a slice. "How old are you?" he asked.
"I'll be 15 this year."
She was tall, and had her mother's figure already, a full bosom and wide womanly hips. "You seem older," he said, looking at her breasts. He intended it as a compliment. Young people generally wanted to seem older, but she blushed and looked away. Ralph looked down at his trencher and speared a chunk of pork cooked with ginger. He ate it moodily. He was not very good at what Gregory called wooing. Caris was seated on the left of Bishop Henri, with Merthyn as alderman on her other side. Next to Merthyn was Sir Gregory Longfellow, who had come for the funeral of Earl William 3 months ago, and had not yet left the neighbourhood. Caris had to suppress her disgust at being at a table with the murdering Ralph, and the man who had, almost certainly, put him up to it. But she had work to do at this dinner. She had a plan for the revival of the town. Rebuilding the walls was only the first part. For the second, she had to get Bishop Henri on her side. She poured the bishop a goblet of clear red Gascon wine, and he took a long draught. He wiped his mouth and said,
"You preach a good sermon."
"Thank you,"
she said, noting the ironic reproof that underlay his compliment.
"Life in this town is degenerating into disorder and debauchery, and if we're to put it right, we need to inspire the townspeople. I'm sure you agree."
"It's a little late to ask whether I agree with you. However, I do."
Henri was a pragmatist who did not refight lost battles. She had been counting on that. She served herself some heron roasted with pepper and cloves, but did not begin to eat. She had too much to say. "There's more to my plan than the walls and the constabulary."
"I thought there might be."
"I believe that you, as the Bishop of Kingsbridge, should have the tallest cathedral in England."
He raised his eyebrows.
"I wasn't expecting that."
200 years ago, this was one of England's most important priories. It should be so again. A new church tower would symbolize the revival, and your eminence among bishops."
He smiled wryly, but he was pleased. He knew he was being flattered, and he liked it. Caris said,
"The tower would also serve the town. Being visible from a distance, it would help pilgrims and traders find their way here."
"How would you pay for it?"
"The priory is wealthy."
He was surprised again. Prior Godwin complained of money problems. He was a hopeless manager. He struck me as rather competent. He struck a lot of people that way, but he made all the wrong decisions. Right at the start, he refused to repair the fulling mill, which would have brought him an income, but he spent money on this palace, which returned him nothing. And how have things changed? I've sacked most of the bailiffs and replaced them with younger men who are willing to make changes. I've converted about half the land to grazing, which is easier to manage in these times of labor shortage. The rest I've leased for cash rents with no customary obligations. And we've all benefited from inheritance taxes and from the legacies of people who died without heirs because of the plague. The monastery is now as rich as the nunnery. So all the tenants are free. Most. Instead of working one day a week on the domain farm and carting the landlord's hay and folding their sheep on the landlord's field and all those complicated services, they just pay money. They like it better, and it certainly makes our life simpler. A lot of landlords, abbots especially, revile that type of tenancy. They say it ruins the peasantry. Carus shrugged. What have we lost? The power to impose petty variations, favoring some serfs and persecuting others, keeping them all subservient? Monks and nuns have no business tyrannizing peasants. Farmers know what crops to sow and what they can sell at market. They work better left to themselves. The bishop looked suspicious. So you feel the priory can pay for a new tower? He had been expecting her to ask him for money, she guessed.
Yes, with some assistance from the town's merchants, and that's where you can help us.
I thought there must be something. I'm not asking you for money. What I want from you is worth more than money.
I'm intrigued. I want to apply to the king for a borough charter. As she said the words, Carus felt her hands begin to shake. She was taken back to the battle she had fought with Godwin 10 years ago that had ended in her being accused of witchcraft. The issue then had been the borough charter, and she had nearly died fighting for it. Circumstances now were completely different, but the charter was no less important. She put down her eating knife and clasped her hands together in her lap to keep them still.
I see, said Henri non-committally.
Carus swallowed hard and went on. It's essential for the regeneration of the town's commercial life. For a long time, Kingsbridge has been held back by the dead hand of priory rule. Priors are cautious and conservative, and instinctively say no to any change or innovation. Merchants live by change. They're always looking for new ways to make money, or at least the good ones are. If we want the men of Kingsbridge to help pay for our new tower, we must give them the freedom they need to prosper. A borough charter. The town would have its own court, set its own regulations, and be ruled by a proper guild, rather than the parish guild we have now, which has no real power.
But would the king grant it?
Kings like boroughs, which pay lots of taxes, but in the past, the prior of Kingsbridge has always opposed a charter.
You think priors are too conservative?
Timid.
Well, said the bishop with a laugh, timidity is a thing you'll never be accused of.
Carus pressed her point. I think a charter is essential if we're to build the new tower.
Yes, I can see that.
So, do you agree?
To the tower or the charter?
They go together. Henri seemed amused.
Are you making a deal with me, Mother Carus?
If you're willing.
All right. Build me a tower, and I'll help you get a charter.
No, it has to be the other way around. We need the charter first.
So I must trust you.
Is that difficult?
To be honest,
no.
Good.
Then we're agreed.
Yes.
Carus leaned forward and looked past Merthyn.
Sir Gregory?
Yes, Mother Carus.
She forced herself to be polite to him. "Have you tried this rabbit in sugar gravy? I recommend it."
Gregory accepted the bowl and took some.
"Thank you."
Caris said to him, "You will recall that Kingsbridge is not a borough."
"I certainly do."
Gregory had used that fact more than a decade ago to outmaneuver Caris in the royal court in the dispute over the fulling mill.
"The bishop thinks it's time for us to ask the king for a charter."
Gregory nodded.
"I believe the king might look favorably on such a plea, especially if it were presented to him in the right way."
Hoping that her distaste was not showing on her face, she said,
"Perhaps you would be kind enough to advise us."
"May we discuss this in more detail later?"
Gregory would require a bribe, of course, though he would undoubtedly call it a lawyer's fee.
"By all means," she said, repressing a shudder.
The servants began clearing away the food. Caris looked down at her trencher. She had not eaten anything.
"Our families are related," Ralph was saying to Lady Philippa.
"Not closely, of course," he added hastily. "But my father is descended from that Earl of Shiring who was the son of Lady Aliena and Jack Builder." He looked across the table at his brother Merthin, the alderman. "I think I inherited the blood of the Earls, and my brother that of the Builders."
He looked at Philippa's face to see how she took that. She did not seem impressed.
"I was brought up in the household of your late father-in-law, Earl Roland," he went on.
"I remember you as a squire."
"I served under the Earl in the King's army in France. At the Battle of Crecy, I saved the life of the Prince of Wales."
"My goodness, how splendid," she said politely.
He was trying to get her to see him as an equal, so that it would seem more natural when he told her that she was to be his wife. But he did not appear to be getting through to her. She just looked bored and a bit puzzled by the direction of his conversation. The dessert was served: sugared strawberries, honey wafers, dates and raisins, and spiced wine. Ralph drained a cup of wine and poured more, hoping that the drink would help him relax with Philippa. He was not sure why he found it difficult to talk to her. Because this was his wife's funeral? Because Philippa was a countess? Or because he had been hopelessly in love with her for years, and could not believe that now, at last, she really was to be his wife?
"When you leave here, will you go back to Earl's Castle?" he asked her.
"Yes. We depart tomorrow."
"Will you stay there long?"
"Where else would I go?" She frowned. "Why do you ask?"
"I will come and visit you there, if I may."
Her response was frosty.
"To what end?"
"I want to discuss with you a subject that it would not be appropriate to raise here and now."
"What on earth do you mean?"
"I'll come and see you in the next few days."
She looked agitated. In a raised voice, she said,
"What could you possibly have to say to me?"
"As I said, it wouldn't be appropriate to speak of it today."
"Because this is your wife's funeral?"
He nodded. She went pale.
"Oh, my God," she said.
"You can't mean to suggest..." "I told you, I don't want to discuss it now."
"But I must know," she cried. "Are you planning to propose marriage to me?"
He hesitated, shrugged, and then nodded.
"But on what grounds?" she said. "Surely you need the king's permission."
He looked at her and raised his eyebrows briefly. She stood up suddenly.
"No,"
she said. Everyone around the table looked at her. She stared at Gregory.
"Is this true?" she said. "Is the king going to marry me to him?"
She jerked a thumb contemptuously at Ralph. Ralph felt stabbed. He had not expected her to display such revulsion. Was he so repellent? Gregory looked reproachfully at Ralph.
"This was not the moment to raise the matter."
Philippa cried,
"So it's true!
God save me!
Ralph caught Odila's eye. She was staring at him in horror. What had he ever done to earn her dislike? Philippa said,
I can't bear it.
Why? Ralph said. What is so wrong? What right have you to look down on me and my family?
He looked around at the company. His brother, his ally Gregory, the bishop, the prioress, minor noblemen and leading citizens. They were all silent, shocked and intrigued by Philippa's outburst. Philippa ignored his question. Addressing Gregory, she said,
I will not do it! I will not! Do you hear me?
She was white with rage, but tears ran down her cheeks. Ralph thought how beautiful she was, even while she was rejecting and humiliating him so painfully. Gregory said coolly,
It is not your decision, Lady Philippa, and it certainly is not mine. The king will do as he pleases.
You may force me into a wedding dress, and you may march me up the aisle,
Philippa raged. She pointed at Bishop Henri. But when the bishop asks me if I take Ralph Fitzgerald to be my husband,
I will not say yes. I will not. Never. Never. Never.
She stormed out of the room, and Odila followed. When the banquet was over, the townspeople returned to their homes, and the important guests went to their rooms to sleep off the feast. Caris supervised the clearing up. She felt sorry for Philippa, profoundly sorry, knowing, as Philippa did not, that Ralph had killed his first wife. But she was concerned about the fate of an entire town, not just one person. Her mind was on her scheme for Kingsbridge. Things had gone better than she imagined. The townspeople had cheered her, and the bishop had agreed to everything she proposed. Perhaps civilization would return to Kingsbridge, despite the plague. Outside the back door, where there was a pile of meat bones and crusts of bread, she saw Godwin's cat, Archbishop, delicately picking at the carcass of a duck. She shooed it away. It scampered a few yards, then slowed to a stiff walk, its white-tipped tail arrogantly upstanding. Deep in thought, she went up the stairs of the palace, thinking of how she would begin implementing the changes agreed to by Henri. Without pausing, she opened the door of the bedroom she shared with Merthyn and stepped inside. For a moment, she was disoriented. Two men stood in the middle of the room, and she thought, I must be in the wrong house, and then, I must be in the wrong room, before she remembered that her room, being the best bedroom, had naturally been given to the bishop. The two men were Henri and his assistant, Canon Claude. It took Caris a moment to realize that they were both naked, with their arms around one another, kissing. She stared at them in shock.
Oh,
she said. They had not heard the door. Until she spoke, they did not realize they were observed. When they heard her gasp of surprise, they both turned towards her. A look of horrified guilt came over Henri's face, and his mouth fell open.
I'm sorry, Caris said.
The men sprang apart, as if hoping they might be able to deny what was going on. Then they remembered they were naked. Henri was plump, with a round belly and fat arms and legs, and grey hair on his chest. Claude was younger and slimmer, with very little body hair except for a blaze of chestnut at his groin. Caris had never before looked at two erect penises at the same time.
I beg your pardon, she said, mortified with embarrassment. My mistake. I forgot.
She realized that she was babbling, and they were dumbstruck. It did not matter. Nothing that anyone could say would make the situation any better. Coming to her senses, she backed out of the room and slammed the door. Merthyn walked away from the banquet with Madge Webber. He was fond of this small, chunky woman, with her chin jutting out in front
and her bottom jutting out behind. He admired the way she had carried on after her husband and children had died of the plague. She had continued the enterprise, weaving cloth and dyeing it red according to Caris's recipe. She said to him, "Good for Caris. She's right as usual. We can't go on like this."
"You've continued normally, despite everything," he said. "My only problem is finding the people to do the work. Everyone is the same. I can't get builders. Raw wool is cheap, but rich people will still pay high prices for good scarlet cloth," Madge said. "I could sell more if I could produce more."
Merthyn said thoughtfully, "You know, I saw a faster type of loom in Florence, a treadle loom."
"Oh?"
She looked at him with alert curiosity. "I never heard of that." He wondered how to explain. "In any loom, you stretch a number of threads over the frame to form what you call the warp. Then you weave another thread crossways through the warp, under one thread and over the next, under and over, from one side to the other and back again, to form the weft. That's how simple looms work, yes. Ours are better."
"I know.
To make the process quicker, you attach every second warp thread to a movable bar, called a heddle, so that when you shift the heddle, half the threads are lifted away from the rest. Then, instead of going over and under, you can simply pass the weft thread straight through the gap in one easy movement. Then you drop the heddle below the warp for the return pass."
"Yes.
By the way, the weft thread is wound on a bobbin. Each time you pass the bobbin through the warp from left to right, you have to put it down, then use both hands to move the heddle, then pick up the bobbin again and bring it back from right to left."
"Exactly.
In a treadle loom, you move the heddle with your feet, so you never have to put the bobbin down."
"Really? My soul!
That would make a difference, wouldn't it?
A huge difference. You could weave twice as much. More."
"That's what I thought. Shall I build one for you to try?"
"Yes, please.
I don't remember exactly how it was constructed. I think the treadle operated a system of pulleys and levers." He frowned, thinking.
"Anyway, I'm sure I can figure it out."
Late in the afternoon, as Caris was passing the library, she met Canon Claude coming out carrying a small book. He caught her eye and stopped. They both immediately thought of the scene Caris had stumbled upon an hour ago. At first, Claude looked embarrassed, but then a grin lifted the corners of his mouth. He put his hand to his face to cover it, obviously feeling it was wrong to be amused. Caris remembered how startled the two naked men had been, and she, too, felt inappropriate laughter bubbling up inside her. On impulse, she said what was in her mind.
"The two of you did look funny."
Claude giggled, despite himself, and Caris could not help chuckling, too, and they made each other worse until they fell into one another's arms, tears streaming down their cheeks, helpless with laughter. That evening, Caris took Merthyn to the southwest corner of the Priory grounds, where the vegetable garden grew alongside the river. The air was mild, and the moist earth gave up a fragrance of new growth. Caris could see spring onions and radishes.
"So, your brother is to be the Earl of Shiring," she said.
"Not if Lady Philippa has anything to do with it."
"A countess has to do what she is told by the king, doesn't she?"
"All women should be subservient to men, in theory," Merthyn said with a grin. "Some defy convention, though."
"I can't think who you mean."
Merthyn's mood changed abruptly. "What a world," he said. "A man murders his wife, and the king elevates him to the highest rank of the nobility."
"We know these things happen," she said, "but it's shocking when it's your own family. Poor Tilly."
Merthyn rubbed his eyes as if to erase visions.
"Why have you brought me here?"
"To talk about the final element in my plan, the new hospital."
"Ah, I was wondering, could you build it here?"
Merthyn looked around. "I don't see why not. It's a sloping site, but the entire priory is built on a slope,
and we're not talking about putting up another cathedral.
One story or two?
One. But I want the building divided into medium-sized rooms, each containing just 4 or 6 beds, so that diseases don't spread so quickly from one patient to everyone else in the place. It must have its own pharmacy, a large, well-lit room for the preparation of medicines, with a herb garden outside, and a spacious, airy latrine with piped water, very easy to keep clean. In fact, the whole building must have lots of light and space. But, most importantly, it has to be at least 100 yards from the rest of the priory. We have to separate the sick from the well. That's the key feature. I'll do some drawings in the morning. She glanced around, and, seeing that they were not observed, she kissed him. This is going to be the culmination of my life's work. Do you realize that? You're 32. Isn't it a little early to be talking about the culmination of your life's work? It hasn't happened yet. It won't take long. I'll start on it while I'm digging the foundations for the new tower. Then, as soon as the hospital is built, I can switch my masons to work on the cathedral. They started to walk back. She could tell that his real enthusiasm was for the tower. How tall will it be? 405 feet. How high is Salisbury? 404. So it will be the highest building in England. Until someone builds a higher one, yes. So he would achieve his ambition too, she thought. She put her arm through his as they walked to the prior's palace. She felt happy. That was strange, wasn't it? Thousands of Kingsbridge people had died of the plague, and Tilly had been murdered, but Carys felt hopeful. It was because she had a plan, of course. She always felt better when she had a plan. The new walls, the constabulary, the tower, the borough charter, and most of all the new hospital. How would she find time to organize it all? Arm in arm with Merthyn, she walked into the prior's house. Bishop Henri and Sir Gregory were there, deep in conversation with a third man who had his back to Carys. There was something unpleasantly familiar about the newcomer, even from behind, and Carys felt a tremor of unease. Then he turned around, and she saw his face, sardonic, triumphant, sneering, and full of malice. It was Philemon. Chapter 74 Bishop Henri and the other guests left Kingsbridge the next morning. Carys, who had been sleeping in the nun's dormitory, returned to the prior's palace after breakfast and went upstairs to her room. She found Philemon there. It was the second time in 2 days that she had been startled by men in her bedroom. However, Philemon was alone and fully dressed, standing by the window, looking at a book. Seeing him in profile, she realized that the trials of the last 6 months had left him thinner. She said, "What are you doing here?" He pretended to be surprised by the question. "This is the prior's house. Why should I not be here?" "Because it's not your room." "I am the sub-prior of Kingsbridge. I have never been dismissed from that post. The prior is dead. Who else should live here?" "Me, of course. You're not even a monk. Bishop Henri made me acting prior, and last night, despite your return, he did not dismiss me from this post. I am your superior, and you must obey me." "But you're a nun, and you must live with the nuns, not with the monks."
"I've been living here for months."
"Alone?" Suddenly Carys saw that she was on shaky ground. Philemon knew that she and Merthyn had been living, more or less, as man and wife. They had been discreet, not flaunting their relationship. But people guessed these things, and Philemon had a wild beast's instinct for weakness. She considered. She could insist on Philemon's leaving the building immediately. If necessary, she could have him thrown out. Thomas and the novices would obey her, not Philemon. But what then? Philemon would do all he could to call attention to what Merthyn and she were up to in the palace. He would create a controversy, and leading townspeople would take sides.
Most would support Caris, almost whatever she did. Such was her reputation. But there would be some who would censure her behavior. The conflict would weaken her authority and undermine everything else she wanted to do. It would be better to admit defeat.
"You may have the bedroom," she said, "but not the hall. I use that for meetings with leading townspeople and visiting dignitaries. When you're not attending services in the church, you will be in the cloisters, not here. A sub-prior does not have a palace." She left without giving him a chance to argue. She had saved face, but he had won. She had been reminded last night of how wily Philemon was. Questioned by Bishop Henri, he seemed to have a plausible explanation for everything dishonorable that he had done. How did he justify deserting his post at the priory and running away to St. John in the Forest? The monastery had been in danger of extinction, and the only way to save it had been to flee, in accordance with the saying, "Leave early, go far, and stay long." It was still, by general consent, the only sure way to avoid the plague. Their sole mistake had been to remain too long in Kingsbridge. Why, then, had no one informed the bishop of this plan? Philemon was sorry, but he and the other monks were only obeying the orders of Prior Godwin. Then why had he run away from St. John when the plague caught up with them there? He had been called by God to minister to the people of Monmouth, and Godwin had given him permission to leave. How come Brother Thomas did not know about this permission, in fact, denied firmly that it had ever been given? The other monks had not been told of Godwin's decision for fear it would cause jealousy. Why, then, had Philemon left Monmouth? He had met Friar Murdo, who had told him that Kingsbridge Priory needed him, and he regarded this as a further message from God. Caris concluded that Philemon had run from the plague until he had realized he must be one of those fortunate people who were not prone to catch it. Then he had learned from Murdo that Caris was sleeping with Merthyn in the prior's palace, and he had immediately seen how he could exploit that situation to restore his own fortunes. God had nothing to do with it. But Bishop Henri had believed Philemon's tale. Philemon was careful to appear humble to the point of obsequiousness. Henri did not know the man, and failed to see beneath the surface. She left Philemon in the palace and walked to the cathedral. She climbed the long, narrow spiral staircase in the northwest tower and found Merthyn in the mason's loft, drawing designs on the tracing floor in the light from the tall, north-facing windows. She looked with interest at what he had done. It was always difficult to read plans, she found. The thin line scratched in the mortar had to be transformed, in the viewer's imagination, into thick walls of stone with windows and doors. Merthyn regarded her expectantly as she studied his work. He was obviously anticipating a big reaction. At first, she was baffled by the drawing. It looked nothing like a hospital. She said, "But you've drawn a cloister." "Exactly," he said. "Why should a hospital be a long, narrow room, like the nave of a church? You want the place to be light and airy. So, instead of cramming the rooms together, I've set them around a quadrangle." She visualized it. The square of grass, the building around, the doors leading to rooms of 4 or 6 beds, the nuns moving from room to room in the shelter of the covered arcade. "It's inspired," she said. "I would never have thought of it, but it will be perfect. You can grow herbs in the quadrangle, where the plants will have sunshine but be sheltered from the wind. There will be a fountain in the middle of the garden for fresh water, and it can drain through the latrine wing to the south and into the river." She kissed him exuberantly. "You're so clever." Then she recalled the news she had to tell him. He must have seen her face fall, for he said, "What's the matter?" "We have to move out of the palace," she said. She told him about her conversation with Philemon, and why she had given in. "I foresee major conflicts with Philemon. I don't want this to be the one on which I make my stand." "That makes sense," he said. His tone of voice was reasonable,
but she knew by his face that he was angry. He stared at his drawing, though he was not really thinking about it.
"And there's something else," she said. "We're telling everyone they have to live as normally as possible. Order in the streets, a return to real family life, no more drunken orgies. We ought to set an example."
He nodded. "A prioress living with her lover is about as abnormal as could be, I suppose," he said. Once again his equable tone was contradicted by his furious expression.
"I'm very sorry," she said.
"So am I. But we don't want to risk everything we both want. Your tower, my hospital, the future of the town.
No,
but we're sacrificing our life together."
"Not entirely.
We'll have to sleep separately, which is painful, but we'll have plenty of opportunities to be together."
"Where?"
She shrugged.
"Here, for example."
An imp of mischief possessed her. She walked away from him across the room, slowly lifting the skirt of her robe, and went to the doorway at the top of the stairs.
"I don't see anyone coming," she said, as she raised her dress to her waist.
"You can hear them anyway," he said. "The door at the foot of the stairs makes a noise." She bent over, pretending to look down the staircase.
"Can you see anything unusual from where you are?"
He chuckled. She could usually pull him out of an angry mood by being playful. "I can see something winking at me," he laughed. She walked back towards him, still holding her robe up around her waist, smiling triumphantly.
"You see? We don't have to give up everything."
He sat on a stool and pulled her towards him. She straddled his thighs and lowered herself onto his lap.
"You'd better get a straw mattress up here," she said,
her voice thick with desire. He nuzzled her breasts.
"How would I explain the need for a bed in a mason's loft?" he murmured. "Just say that masons need somewhere soft to put their tools."
A week later, Carris and Thomas Langley went to inspect the rebuilding of the city wall. It was a big job, but simple, and once the line had been agreed, the actual stonework could be done by inexperienced young masons and apprentices. Carris was glad the project had begun so promptly. It was necessary that the town be able to defend itself in troubled times, but she had a more important motive. Getting the townspeople to guard against disruption from outside would lead, naturally, she hoped, to a new awareness of the need for order and good behavior among themselves. She found it deeply ironic that fate had cast her in this role. She had never been a rule-keeper. She had always despised orthodoxy and flouted convention. She felt she had the right to make her own rules. Now here she was, clamping down on merrymakers. It was a miracle that no one had yet called her a hypocrite. The truth was that some people flourished in an atmosphere of anarchy, and others did not. Merthyn was one of those who were better off without constraints. She recalled the carving he had made of the wise and foolish virgins. It was different from anything anyone had seen before, so Elfric had made that his excuse for destroying it. Regulation only served to handicap Merthyn, but men such as Barney and Lou, the slaughterhouse workers, had to have laws to stop them maiming one another in drunken fights. All the same, her position was shaky. When you were trying to enforce law and order, it was difficult to explain that the rules did not actually apply to you personally. She was mulling over this as she returned with Thomas to the priory. Outside the cathedral, she found Sister Joan pacing up and down in a state of agitation.
"I'm so angry with Philemon," she said. "He claims you have stolen his money, and I must give it back."
"Just calm down," Carris said.
She led Joan into the porch of the church, and they sat on a stone bench.
"Take a deep breath, and tell me what happened."
"Philemon came up to me after terse, and said he needed 10 shillings to buy candles for the shrine of St. Adolphus.
I said I would have to ask you."
"Quite right. He became very angry and shouted that it was the monk's money, and I had no right to refuse him. He demanded my keys,
and I think he would have tried to snatch them from me, but I pointed out that they would be no use to him, as he didn't know where the treasury was.
What a good idea it was to keep that secret, Caris said.
Thomas was standing beside them, listening. He said, I notice he picked a time when I was off the premises. The coward!
Caris said, Joan, you did absolutely right to refuse him, and I'm sorry he tried to bully you. Thomas, go and find him, and bring him to me at the palace.
She left them and walked through the graveyard, deep in thought. Clearly, Philemon was set on making trouble, but he was not the kind of blustering bully whom she could have overpowered with ease. He was a wily opponent, and she must watch her step. When she opened the door of the prior's house, Philemon was there in the hall, sitting at the head of the long table. She stopped in the doorway.
You shouldn't be here, she said. I specifically told you I was looking for you, he said.
She realized she would have to lock the building, otherwise he would always find a pretext for flouting her orders. She controlled her anger.
You looked for me in the wrong place, she said.
I've found you now, though, haven't I? She studied him. He had shaved and cut his hair since his arrival, and he wore a new robe. He was every inch the priory official, calm and authoritative. She said, I've been speaking to Sister Joan. She's very upset.
So am I.
She realized he was sitting in the big chair, and she was standing in front of him, as if he were in charge and she a supplicant. How clever he was at manipulating these things. She said, If you need money, you must ask me.
I'm the sub-prior,
and I'm the acting prior, which makes me your superior. She raised her voice.
So, the first thing you must do is stand up when you're speaking to me.
He started, shocked by her tone. Then he controlled himself. With insulting slowness, he pulled himself out of the chair. Caris sat down in his place and let him stand. He seemed unabashed.
I understand you're using monastery money to pay for the new tower. By order of the bishop,
yes. A flash of annoyance crossed his face. He had hoped to ingratiate himself and make the bishop his ally against Caris. Even as a child, he had toadied unendingly to people in authority. That was how he had gained admission to the monastery. He said, I must have access to the monastery's money. It's my right. The monk's assets should be in my charge.
The last time you were in charge of the monk's assets, you stole them.
He went pale. That arrow had struck the bullseye.
Ridiculous, he blustered, trying to cover his embarrassment. Prior Godwin took them for safe keeping.
Well, nobody is going to take them for safe keeping while I'm acting prior.
You should at least give me the ornaments. They are sacred jewels, to be handled by priests, not women.
Thomas has been dealing with them quite adequately, taking them out for services and restoring them to our treasury afterwards.
It's not satisfactory.
Caris remembered something and interrupted him. Besides, you haven't yet returned all that you took.
The money,
the ornaments. There's a gold candlestick missing, a gift from the Chandler's Guild.
What happened to that?
His reaction surprised her. She was expecting another blustering denial, but he looked embarrassed and said,
That was always kept in the prior's room.
She frowned.
And?
I kept it separate from the other ornaments. She was astonished.
Are you telling me that you have had the candlestick all this time?
Godwin asked me to look after it.
And so you took it with you on your travels to Monmouth and elsewhere?
That was his wish. This was a wildly implausible tale, and Philemon knew it. The fact was that he had stolen the candlestick.
Do you still have it?
He nodded uncomfortably. At that moment, Thomas came in.
There you are, he said to Philemon.
Caris said, "Thomas, go upstairs and search Philemon's room."
"What am I looking for?"
"The lost gold candlestick."
Philemon said, "No need to search. You'll see it on the prie-dieu."
Thomas went upstairs and came down again carrying the candlestick. He handed it to Caris. It was heavy. She looked at it curiously. The base was engraved with the names of the 12 members of the Chandler's Guild in tiny letters. Why had Philemon wanted it? Not to sell or melt down, obviously. He had had plenty of time to get rid of it, but he had not done so. It seemed he had just wanted to have his own gold candlestick. Did he gaze at it and touch it when he was alone in his room? She looked at him and saw tears in his eyes. He said, "Are you going to take it from me?" It was a stupid question. "Of course," she replied. "It belongs in the cathedral, not in your bedroom. The Chandlers gave it for the glory of God and the beautification of church services, not the private pleasure of one monk." He did not argue. He looked bereft, but not penitent. He did not understand that he had done wrong. His grief was not remorse for wrongdoing, but regret for what had been taken from him. He had no sense of shame, she realized. "I think that ends our discussion about your access to the priory's valuables," she said to Philemon. "Now you may go." He went out. She handed the candlestick back to Thomas. "Take it to Sister Joan and tell her to put it away," she said. "We'll inform the Chandlers that it has been found, and use it next Sunday." Thomas went off. Caris stayed where she was, thinking. Philemon hated her. She wasted no time wondering why. He made enemies faster than a tinker made friends. But he was an implacable foe, and completely without scruples. Clearly, he was determined to make trouble for her at every opportunity. Things would never get better. Each time she overcame him in one of these little skirmishes, his malice would burn hotter. But if she let him win, he would only be encouraged in his insubordination. It was going to be a bloody battle, and she could not see how it would end. The flagellants came back on a Saturday evening in June. Caris was in the scriptorium, writing her book. She had decided to begin with the plague and how to deal with it, then go on to lesser ailments. She was describing the linen face masks she had introduced in the Kingsbridge Hospital. It was hard to explain that the masks were effective, but did not offer total immunity. The only certain safeguard was to leave town before the plague arrived and stay away until it had gone, but that was never going to be an option for the majority of people. Partial protection was a difficult concept for people who believed in miracle cures. The truth was that some masked nuns still caught the plague, but not as many as would otherwise have been expected. She decided to compare the masks to shields. A shield did not guarantee that a man would survive attack, but it certainly gave him valuable protection, and no knight would go into battle without one. She was writing this down on a pristine sheet of blank parchment when she heard the flagellants and groaned in dismay. The drums sounded like drunken footsteps, the bagpipes like a wild creature in pain, and the bells like a parody of a funeral. She went outside, just as the procession entered the precincts. There were more of them this time, 70 or 80, and they seemed wilder than before. Their hair long and matted, their clothing a few shreds, their shrieks more lunatic. They had already been around the town and gathered a long tail of followers, some looking on in amusement, others joining in, tearing their clothes and lashing themselves. She had not expected to see them again. The Pope, Clement VI, had condemned flagellants, but he was a long way away at Avignon, and it was up to others to enforce his rulings. Friar Murdo led them, as before. When he approached the west front of the cathedral, Caris saw to her astonishment that the great doors were open wide. She had not authorized that. Thomas would not have done it without asking her. Philemon must be responsible.
She recalled that Philemon on his travels had met up with Murdo. She guessed that Murdo had forewarned Philemon of this visit, and they had conspired together to get